Very sorry to say I did have to go off. I ought to just check, since there are some collaborators here from Washington State and Penn State, there's no Virginia Nichols or Ariel Rivers in the room? Oh, okay. So you can correct me. which bit was your work?
Entomology.
Oh, okay. Well, I've actually deleted some of Bram's slides on that. Anyway, so, yeah. And if Bram was here, he would be the much younger person that Perry was saying you were trying to get at these meetings. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about Bram's work. So, we both work for CIMMYT, the International Maize and Wheat Center. Bram is based in Mexico, and this talk is about the work in Mexico. I'm actually based in Kenya, in Nairobi, but I do work in the same program as Bram. And one of the features of the International Research Centers in the last 10, 15 years is we maybe used to be research organizations, but now we're very much research and development organizations. And some of the innovations that Bram actually was going to talk about today is around those innovations in the research and development sphere. And this is one called Take It to the Farmer. If you work for CIMMYT, you have to acknowledge Norman Borlaug somewhere in every presentation. But when they were talking about moving science out of research stations into things, and Norm apparently said, take it to the farmer, you know, stop talking about it, go and do it. So I'm not sure what the Spanish is for take it to the farmer, but this is part of a government-funded program in Mexico and now in Guatemala, in which CIMMYT is involved with SARGAPA and other organizations, really on the transfer of technology and sustainable intensification technology. It's a fairly recent program. These are locations or the sort of local governments in Mexico, but it's a nationwide program, started in 2008 and it's been slowly rolled out, and each of these sort of states has a hub and a system for dealing with the extension and working with farmers. And CIMMYT now has a collaborative research. There's over 40 different locations in Mexico, in Guatemala. So really a little bit about what Patrick was talking about, research sites in the regions that we want to work in, the areas of interest. And we're very much focused around conservation agriculture-based systems. We know conservation agriculture is contested in some cases. We have a somewhat different view of it in Africa, but nonetheless, it is a sustainable intensification technology and has a lot of benefits. But we know that there are many, many production systems, and as other authors have said, we know that adoption of technology requires local adaptation to the context. So a lot about extension and research and development is taking good ideas and really trying to learn from other people, put them in context, and work out how you can scale them up. All of these platforms are run by national programs, through the Mexican National Program, and the emphasis to begin with was on capacity building and setting up sort of long-term experiments as sites of learning. And now it's beginning to broaden that agenda out to really give those who are in those sites more ownership and capacity to move this process forward themselves. CIMMYT is heading for 50 years, I think, next year. And we have a number of long-term sites, particularly in Obregon and in headquarters in Mexico. So these have been running for more than 25 years. And actually, the people who set these up had a lot of foresight. You know, they put in enough room for 40 treatments and started with 20 that they knew were important at the time, accepting that things change and you need to add new treatments as new problems come in. So a really very, very useful set of data. And I think now we see increasingly how important long-term trials are for research. And we sadly, in Africa, don't have a significant number of these. In Asia, we do have a large number. But really, really important, especially as our capacity to model and to outscale with models and spatial data increases. So you'll all be familiar with conservation agriculture. Are there three, are there four, are there five principles? I don't think it really matters. But basically some form of minimal soil movement, soil cover, and crop rotation No tillage, minimal soil movement. You know, in Africa, we accept that there is going to be some form of tillage in many, many cases. So we're not too hung up exactly about what those are. And as I said, we have to adapt these to local systems. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And Bram, having said three principles, now says four principles. But the fourth principle really is about economic benefit. So even though we can, as scientists, proclaim the long-term benefits of conservation agriculture, farmers are interested in either reducing their costs or increasing their profit margins, or addressing a particular issue. If half your field is washed down the valley every year, you have some incentive to adopt a practice. So it has to be a visible benefit. And that's actually one of the challenges of getting conservation agriculture adopted, is what is the visible benefit. But also, everything to do with crops in particular is also about good management. And I've got plenty of grey hair and remember a time when we used to train huge numbers of agronomists, particularly at a technical level, and that sort of almost disappeared. And we ourselves are now starting to invest far more heavily back into just basic agronomy because that's been lost. So it's about these principles, but it's also about the good agronomy that goes with that. As I said, we have a large number of long-term experiments. Bram and his colleagues have been very productive, so this is all out there in the literature. And because of these long-term experiments are on research stations, you know, we have good capacity, fairly decent repeatability to do a lot of other research and to use them as research and learning platforms. This is just two examples for soil quality and soil physical quality using principal component analysis. I can't tell you which components dominate in here, but you can see on both of these graphs, you've got a graph with ZT keep, so zero tillage plots maintaining residues, and they over time develop different and generally more favourable properties than those that are conventional tillage CT and no residue removal. So we see very significant long-term effects on that, but it does take a long time before these effects become consistent and significant. We also know that conservation agriculture practices are generally beneficial in dry years. In wet years, it's more debatable. I don't think there's so much argument these days about conservation agriculture as there was. The Heretics paper was highly cited, but these debates become more nuanced over time as more data arrives. But I think both here in India and our own experience in Africa is you do see the benefits of conservation agriculture in dry years. And this is just days after planting gate soil water content. And the treatment at the top, the triangles, is the zero tillage with residue. And that's really the most distinct treatment that has an advantage in terms of water conserved. And if you look at the picture at the bottom, we see that we bus people in by the thousand so that they can see the benefits of conservation agriculture. There has to be an entry point and people have to see some visible advantage. And these are just from 2008, 2009, which is a very, very dry year, and the average for 12 years. And you can see overall, zero tillage, maintaining residues, works fairly well and has a long-term yield advantage. In normal years, you don't see a huge difference between some of the other treatments, so it is a long-term and an accumulative effect, but not a single-year effect. These are results from other long-term experiments, both in wheat and rain-fed rice, going back many, many years. So a fair amount of variability over years, but reasonably consistently, the graph on the left-hand side is the conventional tillage with residue. The green dots tend to do better over most of the years. And in the case of irrigated wheat on the right-hand side, at least you can say that maintaining residues is a benefit vis-a-vis removing residues. I should also just say, on the point of residues, systems in Africa and to some extent in Asia, residue retention is a real issue. That's what we really struggle with. So an awful lot of conservation agriculture is minimum tillage only. It's also true in the Middle East. So conserving residues is a real problem. So Simit's been doing this stuff for a long time. What you see in the long-term trials is you begin to see new problems that emerge in this and new opportunities as well. And that's good. You want to be able to innovate in the things you do. And Brown really wanted just to highlight three sort of innovations, one around pest and disease management, one around weed management, and also around machinery improvement. So this was mentioned earlier, that you do get, or you may get, beneficial changes in pest flora. Simit started with, you can correct me, but with work looking at arthropods, beneficial predators in these systems, fairly simple work using predator traps, pitfall traps and direct observations, really to see if there was any discernible change in this case, arthropods in relation to tillage practices. How many years did these studies run for? Good, so thank you. So an important innovation to understand this, and this is driven very much in Mexico also by high pesticide use. So really to try and reduce pesticide. And this type of work has implications everywhere because of in our own systems in Africa, we're actually interested in low input, minimum use systems. So any sort of biological control and advantage you can get out of it in an ecological sense is really quite important to sell that. So this is new and innovative research starting to look at this. I mean, there's a good amount of knowledge on this from other systems, particularly in Europe, where farmers are paid to have beetle banks and all of this stuff to do that. So an interesting area of research. Weeds, we know that over time, dynamics change in these systems, even if you're controlling them. We see this particularly in Africa, where we don't have a lot of chemical weed control, so we see changes in that. Bram highlights that he'd done a recent review of weeds, and now starting to look much more closely at how you control weeds, and this is something we also do in Africa. There are benefits to minimum tillage, because of course you've got no soil disturbance, so you may have changes in seed bank over time, and evidence also that some weeds, which much successful seedling emergence is much less in no-till systems. So you begin to get some possible decline in the weed bank that may be beneficial. As we said, the principles of CA contribute to that, controlling weeds, but we do need to continue to research these systems, particularly if we want to get people off using herbicide. I'm actually interested in encouraging people to use herbicide in Africa, but we don't have yet the tolerance and the issues that exist in glyphosate, and there are other reasons for that. But as Bram said, zero tillage in itself is not great in monoculture. There are a lot of advantages in rotation and other stuff. And this is just a graph from one of the long-term experiments just to show this. So these are the treatments that have herbicide on the red bars and no herbicide on the blue bars. And it's a whole series of treatments. But I think the key thing you can see, if you look at the first three or four columns, these are all wheat monoculture systems. So you see a clear advantage of herbicide use on total weed biomass. But then if you compare that with all of the other treatments moving right, where you start to have rotations of wheat and maize and other treatments, in addition to residue retention and other things, then you'd see much, much lower weed biomasses. So obvious advantages of implementing the principles of conservation agriculture onto weed populations. And this is also really reinforced with Agrastis mexicana, the something love weed, is that correct? Yes, I think so. Anyway, this is in wheat monoculture, but again, you can see on the left-hand side where you've got the monoculture, you've got very, very high levels of infestation. The minute you reduce it down to zero till, you halve that. And where you've got rotations and residues, you've got almost no weed problem. So there's a very effective system at managing weeds over the long term. And again, weeding costs a lot of money, whether it's by herbicide or by hand labor. So this is a benefit in terms of profitability, as well as one hopes a benefit in terms of productivity. Smart mechanization. So we operate in a lot of systems that are fairly small fields. Even in Mexico, there's a lot of small fields, particularly in the south of Mexico. It's not all large scale. And small mechanization is becoming increasingly important because labor is becoming a much greater constraint. Nobody really wants to work with drudgery, and small mechanization is a way out of this, as well as offering advantages of timeliness, precision, etc. If you read the conservation agriculture papers from Asia, you get big benefits from conservation ag. They're all associated with timely planting. Direct drilling, min-till, allows you to plant earlier in rice wheat systems, and that is where you get your gains, even if there are gains from conservation ag per se. So mechanization, the middle picture is these jab planters, small equipment. In Asia, a lot of it is driven by two-wheeled tractors. In Africa now, there's a lot more interested in using two-wheeled tractors and small mechanization, really as a means to increase productivity and reduce drudgery. So we do a significant amount of work on that. And in fact, USAID, some of you know, has just funded through the Sustainable Intensification Innovation Laboratory a small mechanization consortium that is going to be managed by Illinois, I understand. And then lastly, talking about the sort of, I said, we're in research for development. So we do a lot of stuff about transfer of technology, try to understand how to scale technology up. And Bram really was instrumental in helping to set this system up in Mexico. And he would want me to point out that the picture of the scientist at the top is derived from asking 100 farmers what they thought a scientist looked like. And that's not quite Bram, but maybe a little bit of Bram. But anyway, so... But I mean, this was really a reinvigoration of the system, using a hub-type problem, a fairly top-down to begin with, suggesting that you had an operational platform, a research-based platform, moving down to the right to a more adaptive platform where you start having extension, working with farmers, and then eventually a farmer scaling out type model. But the reality of this is innovation systems have a life of their own, fortunately. And even now in Mexico, the hubs are progressing, evolving in different ways, and people are finding also different ways to share and spread this information. And that is really, really good, and the key thing is for us all to learn from that process. As I said, so we started with a really top-down transfer of technology. CA is good, let's go out there and get everyone to implement it. But now this is evolving a lot, and it's becoming perhaps more informal in the networks, more feedback, and our job as researchers is to learn from what actually happens on the farm in order to improve and change our systems, and that will in the end give us a much more dynamic framework. Thank you very much. That I did delete some of his slides to make it shorter.
Yep.
So in Mexico, there's actually a very strong M&E system based around electronic field books and mobile phones. So a lot of on-farm data, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, they collect and they ask people who implement this, including farmers, to collect data and to share it. So there's a very strong M&E, and there's an innovation team that looks at trying to learn what those lessons are and feed it back into the system. So very, very strong component of that program. I mean, informal networks are much harder to measure, but we know that social networks are actually incredibly important in the transfer of knowledge, and perhaps more so in Asia and Africa than maybe in Mexico. Yes. Sometimes they're about information flows and understanding. So network analysis is a fairly common thing we do, particularly in relation to gender. So one of the problems is how do you allow or get women to access to information, because of their networks and their flows are often quite different to those of men. So network analysis is quite a powerful way of doing that. In relation to decision making, actually, I think in general we don't know enough about decision making. Partly because we focus on individual crops, and our technologies are very often crop based and almost field based, because every farmer operates in a system context where essentially, you know, if they have $100. They're making decisions about where to invest that $100. And a lot of the time, of course, agriculture is not the thing that is invested in. So we don't know enough about what really drives decision making. And there is now, I think, a move away from prescribing technology to going to baskets of options. It's really about offering as much choice as you possibly can, and then learning from what happens, and then thinking about how that could be used in a scaling context. But now I think decision making is under researched. We don't really have models that do that. Agent based models a little bit, but you've got to understand the rules in order to do that. So I think a very under researched area. So,
and that's more of an African.
Yeah, well, it's true in a lot of places. So almost all systems are crop livestock systems in some way. Even if they're not, there's always livestock somewhere around. And the reality for maize is the fodder, the stover, is more valuable as a livestock feed than as a crop residue. And even farmers who don't have livestock will usually give it to farmers who have livestock, because it's a trade-off in order for them to get access to animal traction or something like that. So yeah, residue use is almost zero for that reason. And that is why conservation agriculture has been quite hard to scale out in Africa, because of competition for residue. Malawi is almost the only place where there's tens of thousands of adopters. Malawi has almost no livestock for some strange reason. So it's a really, really, really big issue.